John S. Doyle is here with It Says in the Papers.
The Irish Times reports in its lead story that the Department of Health was warned by the health regulator of more than 200 high-risk nursing homes before there was a surge in outbreaks at care facilities during the COVID-19 pandemic. The paper says that officials told the Doyle yesterday that the Health Information and Quality Authority received just an acknowledgement from the department after sending the list, and no response to concerns which it had previously raised about the lack of clinical supervision in the sector. Newly published letters from Nursing Homes Ireland, the body that represents the private and voluntary sector, to the Department of Health, are the focus of the Irish Independent and Irish Daily Mail lead stories. The Independent says the letters lay bare the crisis inside nursing homes, which led to a surge in COVID-19 deaths. And like the Mail, it picks out the detail of staff using painters' overalls for protection. "Nursing home shame," says the Mail headline, and the paper quotes one operator as saying, "We have received eye protection from a local school, overalls from a local vet, and face masks purchased from a dressmaker." The Irish Examiner looks ahead in its lead story. The paper reports a warning from the acting chair of the Fiscal Advisory Council that the next government should not rule out tax increases or freezing public sector pay as debt levels reach near record levels. In its first major report on the economic consequences of COVID-19, the fiscal watchdog said that any new government would face tough choices if it was to meet pledges on sláinte care and housing. "We have all been waiting for this day," so says the lead headline in the Belfast Telegraph, quoting what the North's Health Minister, Robin Swan, said yesterday. It was the first day since the 18th of March that there was no report of a COVID-19 death, the paper says. "First day with zero deaths," says a headline in the Irish News, but that paper leads with a report that Catholic bishops are hoping that new All-Ireland guidelines will allow an early return to public masses. The Irish Sun, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star lead with reports that one of the teenaged boys convicted of murdering Anna Criagel was allegedly beaten up as he watched TV in his detention centre. The Star says that three fellow teenaged offenders carried out the attack and that Gardaí have launched an investigation. The Irish Independent quotes a source as saying that the attack appeared to have been planned. In other stories on the front pages, the Independent says it has seen inspection reports for direct provision centres. What are described as appalling fire safety issues are among the problems revealed at centres across the country. And there are details of overcrowded rooms, insect infestations, heroin use, damp and mould. The Times reports that teachers are being advised that they should securely destroy any supporting documentation they generate in reaching a decision on a student's grades. Carl O'Brien writes that this may include drafts of forms, personal notes or emails in which teachers discuss a student's estimated percentage mark or class ranking in a particular subject. The Department of Education says that the scope of any appeal to a student's grade will not encompass reopening or challenging the professional judgments of teachers or the school, the paper says. The Examiner reports that the long-awaited Munster Technological University was approved yesterday. The Institutes of Technology in Cork and Tralee will merge and become a single institution in January. In Jess Casey's report, the president of CIT, Barry O'Connor, is quoted as saying, "Dublin needs a counterbalance, and the logical place for that is Cork and the South West."
There were 9 more COVID-19 related deaths in this country reported last night, bringing the total number of people with the virus who have died to 1,615. But the number of new cases fell to 37, which is the lowest number since mid-March. We can talk now to our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. Fergal, good morning. And 9 new deaths reported yesterday. There were none the day before. 37 new cases and hospital admissions also falling, as you're reporting this morning. Put those figures in context for us, please.
Well, certainly the situation has stabilised and is reducing. The figures would suggest that. And even Dr. Colm Henry, who's the HSE's clinical lead, said last night that if COVID-19, if it isn't extinguished, it's virtually extinguished. So that's what the figures show us at this point in time. And then the overnight figures give us a similar picture. There's 390 patients in hospital with confirmed or suspected coronavirus. That's down over 100 on the day before. And the numbers in intensive care are stabilizing and reducing slowly. So that is a positive picture at this point in time. It tells us the health system can cope with whatever it's being presented with in terms of COVID-19 at this point in time.
Yes, some very positive statements coming out, and you mentioned that one there from Colm Henry about virtually extinguishing the virus at this point of time. The next couple of days, though, they're going to be critical, aren't they? Because the impact of the lifting of some of the lockdown restrictions will come into effect.
Yes, the National Public Health Emergency Team meets tomorrow to review where we are at. But they have said this week that it'll be sometime into next week, and probably be towards the end of next week that they'll get that, you know, full assessment about the impact of the first easing of restrictions on phase one, and if everything is going, as they say, in the right direction. Now, there may be outbreaks, there may be clusters, there may be some increase in cases between now and then. That wouldn't mean all is lost and that you go into a sudden reverse, because those things are probably going to happen in the weeks ahead, no matter what phase you're in. But if the overall direction and the overall infection rate around the country, and particularly in the community, remains low, you know, at the moment it's 2% positive cases. It was 25%. So you can see the achievement that's been reached there. But they'll be looking at those figures.
The deal with private hospitals, Fergal, that's due to expire at the end of the month. What are you hearing about whether that deal will be extended or not? Because obviously waiting lists are getting longer and longer as this pandemic continues.
They are. I know at the end of this week, the government will review that deal. It runs for 3 months, so into June, but then there's an option to extend it for 2 months after June. It's costing €115 million a month. Now, I've looked at all sorts of figures about the, you know, the activity within private hospitals, and there's conflicting views, but some figures would say about 35% occupancy. Some HSE figures would put it at 50% occupancy in private hospitals. So you, as you know, private hospitals, they're public hospitals for, and the net effect is, given that deal, and it means many people with private health insurance are having delayed or locked out of care in private hospitals as private patients under their insurance. And we have seen from a group of 15 consultants who work in that sector that they say, you know, this could lead to needless deaths and harm, and there's the potential for legal actions by people who have been unable, private patients who've been unable to get their care. So I think the government will look at, you know, the amount of capacity that is available in the public system, which is improving, and the capacity that has been used in the private sector, nothing close to what was actually needed, because the surge didn't happen in the hospital system. It happened a lot in nursing homes. So I think there will be a deal of some sorts done, but probably through the National Treatment Purchase Fund, which will buy a slice of care for public patients from private hospitals, but allow private hospitals to move back to getting on with dealing with private health insured people.
A lot of focus yesterday was on nursing homes, as you mentioned there. Tony Holohan, the chief medical officer, was asked about the lessons which need to be learned. Here's what he had to say.
Now, we're all learning, the international community is learning, and sharing that learning as much as we can to try and improve our learning and our response to this into the future, because although we've suppressed the infection thus far, we're still going to have this virus with us. We're still going to have to offer protection in as much as we can to the population at large, and to the settings that you're asking about, nursing home residents and so on. So this will be a challenge for us on a continuing basis.
That's the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, saying that there are lessons to be learned and will be learned. Did we learn much yesterday from the Oireachtas Committee hearing, Fergal?
Well, look, there was a lot of confusion. It's a bit like doing an air investigation in the middle of a flight emergency before the plane has landed safely. You don't get a clear picture in the middle of a crisis. People are too involved with firefighting. There will be a time when, you know, a calm, objective assessment of what has occurred can be secured. So that would have to look at testing and the timing of the various measures to reduce the spread of the virus. And how we compare, Ireland compares with other countries, for example, in deaths per million. You can see there are some graphs if you go on the web from respected organisations. But at this moment in time, it's very difficult to compare country with country because not all countries are doing the same testing or have the same criteria, or are looking at all deaths, and including suspected deaths, and some report deaths in much later time period, and not in all locations. So at the moment, you know, you have some health officials here saying you have to be very careful if you're comparing Ireland's performance with others, and that's true. But then sometimes they'll go on to say that Ireland is performing very well compared with other countries. We can't have it both ways. So I think the position is to advise caution for now, but this isn't an opportunity to do a forensic objective review of where we're at. We're only coming to the end of phase one, and there may well be other phases.
All right, Fergal, thank you. Fergal Bowers, our health correspondent there.
The Chief Medical Officer, as you heard, there will meet government ministers at around midday today, and there'll be more talks about forming a new government. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, is watching. Morning, Paul.
Morning.
Will some ministers ask Tony Holohan to relax the 2 metre guidance?
That's what we expect is going to happen, and it comes on foot of a detailed cabinet discussion last Friday in which several ministers argued that given the World Health Organization had given a guidance that 1 metre was deemed to be safe, we should consider implementing such a measure because here in Ireland, because the current state and rule is that it should be 2 metres. And what Leo Varadkar did was that there was a scheduled meeting with the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, and he suggested that, well, that discussion can be folded into the meeting. So that meeting is now going to take place at 1:45 at government buildings, and we expect that the feelings that were expressed on Friday still exist today, because many ministers feel that if we had a 1 metre social distancing rule, that would have huge ramifications, positive ramifications for example, the reopening of schools, which would make it easier for school managers to bring children back, and also most particularly for businesses, particularly small businesses, restaurants, cafes, that if there was a social distance of 1 metre, they'd be better able to reopen and ensure that customers could come back in. So that's the basis of the argument.
Do you know which ministers are most vocal about this?
We have not had a readout of which ministers said what and where, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens after this meeting. As I understand it, there isn't going to be a formal press conference afterwards, so the ministers themselves will be coming out of the meeting and we'll be no doubt asking them what did they have to say. I mean, as far as we understand it, the Chief Medical Officer wants to update them on the broad fight against COVID-19, to tell them how the roadmap for opening up Ireland is progressing, because as we know, it's what the government calls a living document in which the dates on it aren't set in stone. It depends on medical advice. So there'll be a broad discussion on how Dr. Holohan sees things going. But we know in particular there are ministers who want to address this issue, so we should get a better sense of how things stand after that meeting.
Government formation talks, Paul. What's happening?
Well, we know that they're going to move on to the issue of childcare and transport today. Yesterday, they were dealing with broader macroeconomic issues like capital expenditure. But you always have to be cautious in these talks. It's a bit of a rolling discussion in which you might talk about one topic today, but other issues which you've been talking about in previous days will come back because either a solution has been found, or because the topics overlap with another, or because maybe people higher up in the party structure have overcome a problem, and then that's folded back into negotiation. So they are rolling discussions, but childcare and transport are the key issues today, I understand.
We're coming towards the end of May. How soon do you think it'll be before a programme for government is drafted between the three parties?
Well, the date has slipped. We had expected that it was going to be this Friday. Then on the Late Late Show last week, Micheál Martin signalled that it was going to be early next week. I was talking to one senior negotiator who exited the talks at Agriculture House on Kildare Street last night, and they said they were still pretty confident that early next week, Monday or Tuesday, would be the day that the text would be signed off. However, you never can be sure. There were sources from a different party yesterday suggesting that because agriculture, a key issue, a controversial issue, was being left till late in the negotiations. That mean it could result in that slipping to Wednesday or Thursday. So there's a degree of uncertainty about it. We're not sure. It depends on how things go. But the senior negotiator, I was saying, said touchwood will be done by Tuesday. So that's where things stand at the moment.
And even after that point, Paul, each party has to agree amongst themselves.
Exactly. I mean, what usually would happen is the negotiating teams would conclude their negotiation. It would go to the three leaders of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party. At that point, then, if it was signed off, we know that independents are also going to be brought into the discussions. So maybe things could change once again. And even at that point, at the end of next week, when a text is signed off, if a text is signed off, it would then go to the individual party memberships, and they've got different criteria how they would assess such a document. So we're still looking at second week in June, maybe even third week in June, before we get some finality to this and find out if this is a document and if this is going to be a new government.
Paul, we'll be talking to the chair of the Fiscal Advisory Council later, who's warning that of tax rises and spending cuts ahead. Are the parties ready for that?
I think no negotiator has gone in and sat around the table without being incredibly mindful of the huge financial problems which we are facing as a nation in the months ahead. We know that even from the Department of Finance, about looking at the deficit has jumped from 20 to 25 to 30, people expecting it to go forward. So no one can be without a clear idea that we have big, big problems. And I think they're very much aware of it. Obviously, the question is, can they arrive at a compromise approach on whether, you know, how to approach this? We do know that there are those recommending that we need to sort of flood businesses with money to keep them afloat, as otherwise you're going to have much higher social welfare payments. So the question is, can these three parties agree on a plan? But be in no doubt, they're aware of just exactly how bad things are.
Paul, thank you. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. The time coming up to 27 minutes past 7.
Close to 20,000 visitors should be gathering in Listowel in County Kerry from tonight, when the town's Writers' Week festival was due to get underway. The pandemic, however, has seen the festival cancelled when it should have been celebrating its 50th staging. Joe Stack has been getting the reaction of business people and organisers in Listowel to a summer without its famous Writers' Week.
The midnight ball. When the clock strikes 12 and the world flips, I shall leap and fall.
14-year-old Ruth McCarthy reads from her Listowel Writers' Week winning poem, The Midnight Ball. Thousands of visitors should be thronging the North Kerry town from tonight, when the 50th running of Ireland's oldest literary and arts festival was due to open. Instead, the pandemic has dealt a major financial and cultural blow.
Good morning, Listowel Writers' Week. I'm afraid disappointing news. All right, we're not going ahead.
Catherine Moylan is the festival chairperson.
I suppose at this stage the town would be decorated in literary themes. Every shop window, there would be banners and posters in every street and shop window. And at this stage we're waiting for 19,000 people to descend upon the town and add a new energy and excitement and merriment and a giddiness, really, I suppose. Usually Wednesday evening before the festival, there's an air of anticipation and giddiness.
North Kerry doesn't enjoy the same summer tourism numbers as their neighbours in the south of the county. Take away a festival then, worth in the region of €2 million to the local economy, and the loss is keenly felt. Here's taxi driver Tom O'Connor.
As you know, there's an international dimension to Writers' Week, and that involves quite a lot of airport work. Mainly through Kerry Airport, arrivals, departures, Kerry Airport, Cork Airport and Shannon Airport. Business-wise, it's a huge blow. It would be, for me, it would be the busiest week of the year.
This is the sound of Listowel Arms hotel owner Kevin O'Callaghan turning the key on his own locked front door. The town's only hotel should be booked out and thronged with festival patrons all this week.
So Joe, we've got a 42-bedroom hotel here at the Listowel Arms, and over the 5 nights, coupled with the races afterwards, you know, we're looking at 300-odd bed nights that we've lost there. That's immense in our month of May turnover and for the whole year.
Well, that picture there on the wall is the first ever Writers' Week 50 years ago. It's up on the wall 50 years as well.
John B. Keane's bar should also be gearing up for the festival. Proprietor Billy Keane reckons Writers' Week and the Harvest Racing Festival in September accounts for as much as 20% of his entire annual turnover. Yet Billy insists it's the social hit that's just as painful as the economic one.
It's the morale as well. People love to see the streets busy and they go into the B&Bs. There are some temporary B&Bs for the week. They go in maybe as guests. They leave as best friends or maybe even lovers. And the relationship continues. It's just the looking forward to painting up the front of the pub, getting ready, being excited. The superstars of world literature to come in here. You know, you could have a Nobel Prize winner walk in the door here and no one takes much notice that they get their point, you know.
Despite the disappointment, Listowel is determined to look optimistically towards the future. Organisers insist the festival's 50th birthday is not cancelled, but merely deferred until 2021.
But you know, in this exact square 50 years ago, a group of people got together with the idea to celebrate local talent, local literary talent, and also to create an audience for emerging writers. So I think, you know what, 50 years later, we'll still be able to do that.
It's going to come back, though, you know, and you can look around the pub here and you would get down, but I know that we'll be here talking and singing and laughing and carousing again. It's just a matter of time, but we will be back and Writers' Week will be back, and absence makes the heart grow fonder.
No literary footfall then in 2020, but the writing competitions have gone ahead. The winners, including that of the prestigious Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year Award, will be announced later tonight.
And let's hope we do see it back very soon. Joe Stack reporting there from Listowel in his home county of Kerry. Adam Maguire is here with the business news.
Thanks, Justin. Hibernia REIT says its portfolio of properties was worth more than €1.46 billion in the year to the end of March. That's up 2% year on year, according to results published this morning. The company owns 34 properties, all in Dublin, and the majority of them offices. Hibernia REIT said the market outlook was negative in the short term as the impact of COVID-19 on rents and valuations was still unclear. However, it said it had sufficient headroom to deal with a shock and says it could withstand a 65% fall in asset values. Meanwhile, drinks company Britvic has reported a 9% fall in revenues in the 6 months to the end of March, though it blamed much of that on a change in the way it's reporting and currency fluctuations. At the same time, pre-tax profit hit £38.9 million, which is up 11.5% year on year. Britvic owns drinks brands like Ballygown, My Waddy and Club and says they enjoyed gains in Ireland in the start of the year. And France's economy could contract by as much as 20% in the second quarter, according to its statistics agency. That's due to lockdown measures cutting activity. Finally, for now, the currencies where €1 buys you 88.9 pence sterling and $1 and 9.6 cents.
Now, coronavirus has decimated not just the health services of major EU countries, but also their economies. And today, the European Commission will unveil its recovery plan. France and Germany have already proposed a jointly financed fund to help cushion the blow of recession. But there's opposition from the so-called Frugal Four of Sweden, Denmark, Austria and the Netherlands. They want any aid to take the form of loans, which must be paid back, rather than grants, which would not have to be repaid. To tell us more, we can talk to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Justin.
How much money are we talking about here, and where will it come from, crucially?
Yeah, well, the actual overall figure is still a tightly guarded secret. The Commission President Ursula von der Leyen will address the European Parliament this afternoon once the European Commission, the College of Commissioners, adopts this proposal. But I think the French and German proposal of a recovery fund of €500 billion is probably a good guideline as to where we're going to be going with the kind of money that we're talking about. We've already, of course, had €540 billion, which has been approved, and that's by way of soft loans from the European Investment Bank, the European Stability Mechanism, which is the big EU bailout fund, and another fund that the European Commission is going to mobilise on the markets. But this would be an extra recovery package, which is really designed to try and help economies recover and then kind of relaunch the European economy and to make it fit for the 21st century, if you like, and then to spend money by learning the lessons of this pandemic. So money would be then targeted at the areas where European countries really fell down when the pandemic hit For example, making sure there's the right medical equipment, making sure there's protective gear for staff, frontline staff and health workers and so on. So they're trying to launch this huge package of money to restart the economy and to try and make Europe more resilient if something like this happens in the future.
And,
so where will the money come from?
Yes, there's talk, Tony, isn't there, of generating this money from environmental taxes and so on?
Yeah, so what they're going to do is they're going to, there's a two-pronged approach to this. One is that the EU's seven-year budget cycle is about to be rolled over into the next 7 years. And what they want to do is to kind of repurpose the European budget, first of all, to generate more cash and then to transfer the money through the budget mechanisms. Because if you like, the cohesion money that countries get at the moment, that's not a loan, that's a grant. So you could use these kind of channels to get money quickly to people. So what they want to do is they want to increase the ceilings of the budget and they would raise money by new tax resources, for example, using the emissions trading system in Europe, using a plastics tax to generate more funds. And then that would be used as collateral by the Commission to go to the markets and borrow very cheaply using their AAA rating to raise a much more substantial amount of money, which would then be channeled to member states, either by way of loans or by way of grants. Each member state would be expected to draw up a reform program to show where the money is most urgently needed, whether it's in the health service, whether it is to help particular industries. And then that's how the thing would roll out with, I would say, fairly long maturity times for those loans. So the big political debate after this proposal has been launched will be, should the money come as loans or grants or some kind of mixture of
yes.
both?
And that's a power struggle effectively between the alliance of France and Germany, who are talking about grants, and the Frugal Four, Sweden, Denmark, Austria and the Netherlands, who are talking about loans. How do you see that playing out?
Yes, I mean, that's really the fault line of this debate, because the countries that have been hardest hit, like Italy, Spain and France, they would say there's no point in simply adding to our debt pile if we're trying to cope with the aftermath of this catastrophe. Whereas the Frugal Four, as you mentioned, are simply saying, we cannot allow our voters and our citizens to be on the hook for money that is going to go to another country. I think the fact that France and Germany came out with their own proposal last week is very significant, because Germany would have been regarded as certainly sympathetic to the Frugal Four. And the fact that France and Germany have gone on to the same wavelength on this, then that will certainly help to undermine the effectiveness of the Frugal Four. So I think the balance is shifting away from loans to grants. But I think ultimately it'll fall somewhere in the middle.
And finally, Tony, just and briefly, if you would, what does this mean for Ireland? I mean, is there danger ahead? Because that Franco-German proposal, it does propose the abolition of some preferential tax regimes as part of any bailout package, and that may have implications for us, would it?
Well, certainly a common consolidated corporate tax base, which is an issue that Ireland has been uncomfortable with, to say the least, for a long time. That is regarded as perhaps one way of helping to generate extra funds. Also, a digital tax is an idea that the French have come forward with. And of course, again, that's an issue that Ireland has resisted, unless it's done at a global level. I think overall, Ireland will be very supportive of this fund. I understand that Ireland will explore any available revenue streams that could come forward because of this fund. But there's also, I think, a recognition that Ireland is a net contributor, and we may end up as a net contributor spending more or putting more money into this fund than we get out of it. And that would apply to other countries as well, even though Ireland has been badly hit. But of course, every other country has been very badly hit by the pandemic.
All right, Tony Connolly, our Europe editor, thank you very much for talking to us, and we shall see the full detail of that plan later today. Now, over half the charities operating here have said that they might not be able to continue providing services for more than 6 months. That's according to a survey published by the charities regulator earlier this month. The sector is facing what it describes as an unprecedented strain due to the economic impact of COVID-19. The issue will be discussed at an online summit hosted by The Wheel, which is an umbrella group representing over 1,200 different charities. Its chief executive, Deirdre Garvey, is on the line. Deirdre Garvey, good morning.
Good morning, Justin.
You say that charities are under an unprecedented strain. Can you give us an idea of what you're talking about?
I can indeed, but first I must just express my sympathy for the nearly 400,000 people who've lost their lives globally and the families and friends who mourn them. And I guess if there's anything positive to take from recent times is that we've seen what society can be when community values are prioritised. And as you say, charities have been playing a key role in mitigating the impact of the pandemic and indeed our societies anyway. But that funding for many of the essential social and community services is going to run out in the community in the coming months. So there is increased demand for their services at a time of decreased funding. And I guess behind all of this work in the organisations are costs like insurance, equipment, buildings, wage costs for qualified staff and governance costs. And that infrastructure within the organisations needs funding to continue the vital services, because that's what it's all about.
Charities, of course, is a very broad term, but what you're talking about here in many cases are actually health services, which are not being provided by the state.
Indeed, of the 14 billion euro that flows through Ireland's 10,000 charities every year, half of it, that 7.5 billion euro of it, is coming from the government, basically on contract for services. So Ireland's charities deliver a huge range of essential health and social care services on behalf of the state with this 7.5 billion euro. And indeed, the other 7.5 billion euro is generated from charities themselves through fundraising, through charging for some services, etc. So a lot of the state services, state-funded services, are in effect subsidised by self-generated income. And it's that fundraised income and the self-generated income that has come under huge pressure and practically collapsed in the last number of months, and it doesn't show signs of being able to improve. So what we're saying is that if we're going to nurture this really, really important infrastructure of the sector, small, medium and large organisations in our local communities, the Meals on Wheels, the befriending services, right through to the essential health and social care services, we're going to need strong, tangible support from any incoming government.
Might we see the consolidation of some services as well in the coming months? Because I read a figure some time back that Ireland has, to take one example, 48 charities which deal with the issue of suicide, for example. Now, that's obviously a very important area, but it does beg the question, if there's too much duplication of services in some areas, and does that need to be addressed as well as part of this crisis?
Well, what we're saying is that there needs to be a strong engagement with government, and I'm very happy to say that the government has signalled that they will engage further with community and voluntary organisations and charities to understand the depths of the problem. Because we may have charities doing things in different parts of the country, but it might look like they're doing the same things. There might even be parts of the country where that service doesn't exist at all. So what we need to do is have a plan and a partnership working with government. We need a senior cabinet level minister in the next government. We need particularly a sustainable funding model for the services that we provide, and we need a working group on how those services are to be funded. We need a framework for collaboration. As you say, there are many partnerships we have seen in the last number of months that never happened before. We've all heard the radio ads for the Community Call, a unique partnership with local authorities and local community and voluntary organisations. We want a collaborative partnership to build on those new relationships.
We want to involve healthcare reform with charities. If you're making the case that charities are struggling, don't the charities too need to step up to the mark and cut their costs, even if that means merging some charities because there's a duplication of services being provided?
If that is the case, then absolutely yes. And until we actually have the ability to investigate, explore and get the evidence, because there may be, I guess, synergies and costs and that can be cut. We also know that since the last recession, the actual full cost of these services has never been replaced in the first place. So many charities are actually already underfunded going into this crisis. So it's not a one size fits all. And I think that's the particular need that we have, because charities employ 180,000 people in this country. So we're part of the economy as well as part of the social infrastructure. And that's the nub of it. And I think all of the listeners here today and everybody in Ireland has seen the frontline work of Ireland's charities as the cocooning phase of the pandemic has really come to the fore. The solidarity, the compassion, the care that these organisations have day in, day out, year in, year out. And we need to preserve that for the future, because now is the opportunity to shape the future so the economy sustains lives as well as profit and nurtures the community values as well as the community and voluntary action that have really served us so well in recent months.
OK, Chief Executive of The Wheel, Deirdre Garvey, thank you very much for joining us on Morning Ireland. The time is 7:49.
Adam Maguire has the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. Well, COVID-19 may have closed the country's schools, but it's not put a halt to the many enterprises established by students in recent months. They're set to be celebrated at an awards ceremony run by the country's local enterprise office network later today. But given the circumstances, this year's event will be held virtually rather than in Croke Park as previously planned. Ahead of that, I'm joined by the chair of the network of LEOs, as well as one of the students behind one of the firms up for an award today. First to LEO Chair Oisín Geoghegan. Oisín, 85 student enterprises up for awards today. Is that a record number?
It's actually very similar, Adam, to previous years. We always have a very strong take-up of this particular programme throughout the schools in every county in Ireland, and in every town and village in Ireland. Indeed, students have been participating in the Student Enterprise Programme. There's a very strong interest in it. So what we're seeing is it's really enabling students to kind of think creatively about how they may set up a business. Very importantly, it's providing a mechanism whereby they can learn the real life business skills in a kind of a safe environment, and an environment which is very constructive, where they are guided with a given guidance. So yeah, we have 85 finalists, but there have been over the last since 2003 over 200,000 students participating in this program throughout the country. So There's huge numbers that come through this every year.
This year, environment and sustainability seems to be a big trend. Tells us a lot about the priorities of young people at the moment.
It really does, indeed. And we've seen that trend over the last couple of years. But this year, there's more than ever now. We see a lot of the small businesses that have been established are addressing environmental issues, and they're looking at kind of sustainable business practices. And that's something that we're very keen to embed into this programme.
Well, on that topic, one of the people behind one of the businesses is Dana Kearney O'Brien. She's a student behind The Last Straw, one of the students anyway. That's aiming to tackle the number of plastic straws being used by selling its own reusable metal alternative. Dana, you're running the business with three others. Why did you decide to build a business around straws?
Yeah, well, back in September, when we're trying to come up with an idea for our enterprise, there was a lot in the news about Greta Thunberg and about how we are affecting the environment as a society. And so it was a topic that we knew that we couldn't ignore. And as a group of friends, we were sitting at McDonald's and we realised that we didn't like the paper straws, as they were quite soggy. And we did a bit of research and found that reusing was better than recycling. And we came up with an alternative, which was to sell stainless steel reusable straws. And we call our company The Last Straw, as it's the last straw anyone would ever need to buy.
You've had a lot of success so far as well. Tell us who's been buying your straws.
Yeah, so at the start of the year, we got in contact with John Byrne, who's the operations manager of 5 McDonald's outlets in Leinster. He has 2 in Blanchardstown, 2 in Carlow, and 1 in Wexford. And thankfully, he was so on board with our idea to provide reusable straws in his outlets. And he allowed us to use them outlets as a platform to sell our straws. And now they're being sold through the drive-thrus. And before COVID-19, they were being sold at the counter. So the customer had the opportunity to go with the sustainable option.
How hard has it been to run this business with your co-founders while the schools have been closed?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. The McDonald's outlets, unfortunately, had to close. But we have, thankfully, we have our own website set up It's called thelaststraw.ie, with a hyphen between last and straw. And we were able to sell our products directly to customers from the website.
What have you learned from all of this? And is it something that you'd like to continue beyond the Student Enterprise Programme?
Yeah, it's been an absolutely surreal experience. And it's so good to get that first-hand experience and have an insight to what the business world is really like and the difficulties it brings, but also the reward that it brings. At the end of the day, we're doing our part for the environment. And yeah, I think it's so good to get that experience. And I can see myself in the future, and I'm sure the girls do as well, continuing and owning our own business as a way of life.
Well, very best of luck today with the awards and in the business overall. Donna Carney O'Brien, one of the students behind The Last Straw. Thanks to LEO Chair Oisín Gagan. More business news in the next hour. For now, though, it's back to you, Justin.
Now, a lovely warm morning out there. Let's get a check on the weather for the day ahead with Joanna Donnelly from Met Éireann.
Good morning. Dry for the day ahead and a lovely morning for the week ahead as well. Temperatures are really the only news I'll have for you today, between 20 and 24 degrees widely across the country. About 15 to 17 degrees at the coasts, and as high as 27 degrees is possible in isolated spots where the longest spells of sunshine develop, but sure, the sun is likely to be widespread all day today. Now, the last of the cloud is fizzling away already. Winds will be light and variable in direction. The anticyclone is sitting directly over Ireland. Now, we'll shift eastwards, and that'll put us into a little bit of a southeast wind during tomorrow, Thursday. In the meantime, it'll be dry and clear tonight too. Temperatures overnight tonight, 7 to 9 degrees over the northern half of the country, about 11 to 13 degrees over the southern half of the country. And tomorrow is going to be hot. Temperatures about 25 degrees widely across the country, 20 degrees even at the coasts. And it's possible that we'll see 29 degrees recorded in parts of the west of the country tomorrow. It's going to be a dry, hot and sunny day. And the outlook is for continued dry, warm or hot and sunny days through to the weekend. Now, the overnight temperatures are between about 10 and 13 degrees. We're not quite at the heat stress criteria, but we are looking at quite uncomfortable conditions, particularly in the daytime in any buildings with flat roofs, etc. So if you're anxious or worried about people with vulnerabilities to breathing difficulties, etc., do take extra care around this time, because it is going to get uncomfortably hot indoors and people need to open up the windows and get out for some cool or fresher air. And that's the outlook too. The only chance of some rain is on Friday evening and into Friday night, where we might see some showers developing along western coasts, but that's about it. That's it. Enjoy.
Good morning again on Wednesday, the 27th of May. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Justin McCarthy and Gavin Jennings. The news is read by Brian Jennings.
The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, will brief Cabinet Ministers this afternoon on progress in tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Some Cabinet members are expected to raise Ireland's 2 metre social distancing rule and inquire if it can be reduced. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham.
The Chief Medical Officer Tony Holohan is expected to give his analysis on the latest medical data, as well as brief ministers on how the COVID-19 roadmap is progressing at today's lunchtime meeting. Afterwards, ministers will have the opportunity to raise their concerns, and a key issue is expected to be the 2 metre social distancing rule. At Cabinet last Friday, some ministers argued that if it was reduced to 1 metre, in line with guidance from the World Health Organization, it would greatly benefit business and school reopenings. On Monday, Dr. Holohan said the 2 metre guidance is not a hard and fast rule, but added his team thought it was a reasonable compromise given where we're currently at. Today, ministers will press for the CMO to give clarity on when that might change.
The government has been advised to introduce a significant stimulus plan for the economy once the immediate COVID-19 crisis is over. However, the budgetary watchdog, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, has also warned that all options must be kept on the table, including spending cuts and tax rises, to bring the public finances back in line once recovery takes hold. Our economics correspondent, Robert Short.
The Irish Fiscal Advisory Council is advising the government to implement a significant plan of investment to stimulate the economy back to life. but this will have to be paid for. So it's advising an incoming government to leave all options on the table through different combinations of spending reductions and tax increases to bring the public finances back from what's expected to be historic levels of public debt. However, the council says that even under its worst-case scenario of repeated new waves of coronavirus, the expected adjustment will be less than half of what was done following the financial crisis.
The Irish Congress of Trade Unions has cautioned against the sudden removal of financial supports introduced because of the pandemic. It has also called for a fundamental programme of economic and social reform. In a document entitled No Going Back, Congress proposes a new deal to build a fairer society while boosting economic recovery. It notes that the pandemic has opened up opportunities to consider policies that would previously have been deemed politically impossible. The European Commission will today announce a recovery plan designed to help the European economy rebound from the devastation of the coronavirus pandemic. The Commission President Ursula von der Leyen will outline the plans to the European Parliament this afternoon. Combined with some €540 billion already agreed by member states, today's announcement could bring the overall rescue package to more than €1 trillion. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
The sums envisaged remain a tightly guarded secret. However, France and Germany have already jointly proposed that the recovery fund should be around €500 billion. That would be on top of €540 billion already available by way of the EU's bailout fund, soft loans from the European Investment Bank, and money mobilised by the Commission to help companies keep workers on their books. It's understood the plan will partly revolve around repurposing the EU's seven-year budget. Member states remain divided over how much of the recovery plan will be loans and how much will be grants, with the worst-hit countries in the south arguing that loans will simply add to their debt burden. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
A further significant drop in the number of cases of COVID-19 in hospitals has been reported overnight. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
There are now 390 patients with confirmed or suspected coronavirus in hospitals. That's a reduction of 111 cases compared with the HSE's figures published yesterday. The hospitals caring for the most cases are the Mater, Connolly and Beaumont. 48 patients are in intensive care units with confirmed COVID-19, plus 14 suspected cases. It means that the hospital system currently has 108 intensive care beds vacant for all illnesses. Overall, there are 907 vacant general beds in acute hospitals. The HSE has said that COVID-19 has been virtually extinguished in the country at this point.
Clashes have erupted on the streets of Hong Kong between police and pro-democracy activists. Demonstrators chanted slogans during a lunchtime rally in the city's central district, but dispersed when officers fired multiple rounds of irritant-filled pellets. Later today, the territory's legislature will debate proposed legislation that would make it illegal to disrespect the Chinese national anthem. Leaving certificate students have two more days to register for the new calculated grade system. Last night, almost 38,000 students had filled in the online forms. The new system replaces the traditional examination, which is not being held this year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Students have until 10 o'clock tomorrow night to register. A motorcyclist in his 30s has died after his bike was in collision with a tractor in County Mayo. The incident happened on the N59 between Mulranny and Newport at around 8:30 last night. The road is closed in both directions and local diversions are in place. Twitter has for the first time labelled tweets by the US President Donald Trump as misleading. He has accused the social network of stifling free speech. Now the time is coming up to 8:08.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Centra. Make the most of summer. We've everything you need at Centra.
It'll be cloudy at first with drizzle on northern coasts and fog patches on southern and western coasts. It will become sunny everywhere as the day goes on. Highest temperatures will range from 20 to 24 degrees.
Time to take a check on what it says in the papers with John S. Doyle.
The Irish Times report in its lead story that the Department of Health was warned by the health regulator of more than 200 high-risk nursing homes before there was a surge in outbreaks at care facilities during the COVID-19 pandemic. The paper says that officials told the Doyle yesterday that the Health Information and Quality Authority received just an acknowledgement from the department after sending the list and no response to concerns which it had previously raised about the lack of clinical supervision in the sector. Newly published letters from the body that represents the private and voluntary sector, Nursing Homes Ireland, to the Department of Health are the focus of the Irish Independent and Irish Daily Mail lead stories. The Independent says the letters lay bare the crisis inside nursing homes, which led to a surge in COVID-19 deaths. And like the Mail, it picks out the detail of staff using painters' overalls for protection. Nursing home shame, says the Mail headline, and the paper quotes one operator as saying, "We have received eye protection from a local school, overalls from a local vet, and face masks purchased from a dressmaker. We have all been waiting for this day," so says the lead headline in the Belfast Telegraph, quoting what the North's Health Minister, Robin Swan, said yesterday. It was the first day since the 18th of March that there was no report of a COVID-19 death, the paper says. First day with zero deaths, says a headline in the Irish News, but that paper leads with a report that Catholic bishops are hoping that new All-Ireland guidelines will allow an early return to public masses. The Irish Sun, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star lead with reports that one of the teenage boys convicted of murdering Anna Criagel was allegedly beaten up as he watched TV in his detention centre. The Star says that three fellow teenage offenders carried out the attack and that Gardaí have launched an investigation. The Independent quotes a source as saying that the attack appeared to have been planned. In other stories on the front pages, The Independent says it has seen inspection reports for direct provision centres. What are described as appalling fire safety issues are among the problems revealed at centres across the country. And there are details of overcrowded rooms, insect infestations, heroin use, damp and mould. The Irish Examiner reports that the long-awaited Munster Technological University was approved yesterday. The Institutes of Technology in Cork and Tralee will merge and become a single institution in January. The Examiner looks ahead in its lead story too. The paper reports a warning from the acting chair of the Fiscal Advisory Council that the next government should not rule out tax increases or freezing public sector pay as debt levels reach near record levels. In its first major report on the economic consequences of COVID-19, the fiscal watchdog said that any new government would face tough choices if it was to meet pledges on sláinte care and housing. In a comment piece in The Times, the consultant medical oncologist John Crown says that only true funding reform can fix the problems in the hospital system. He writes that simply making something like VHI universal with a reformed progressive premium structure and free premiums for the unwaged could fund a hospital system remarkably similar to the successful socialised programmes of Germany and France, and far superior to the UK's NHS. Crown says while the emergency coronavirus measures allegedly put a temporary end to two-tiered healthcare, it produced the type of equality that the Lusitania achieved with the Titanic when it joined it on the ocean floor.
From tomorrow, if you arrive in Ireland from any other country, you will, by law, have to fill in a form called the COVID-19 Passenger Locator Form, saying where you can be contacted. You'll also be asked to self-isolate for 14 days. The Minister for Health, Simon Harris, says making it mandatory to self-isolate is tricky, legally. Ryanair's Group CEO Michael O'Leary says the quarantine guidance is unfair, ineffective and unimplementable and should be removed. But Simon Harris says the measures, while extraordinary, are necessary in a time of public health crisis.
I do disagree that the measures are utterly ineffective. But let me start by saying, look, the government has done a great job. The health authorities have done a great job. I mean, Monday was a great day for Ireland when we had zero deaths from COVID. But Ireland, like many other European countries, is now emerging out of the lockdown period. And we're emerging much slower and in a much more conservative and restrictive manner than most other European countries. We can and should do more. It's time to get the economy moving.
Well, the current measures will be in place until the 18th of June when they'll be reviewed. And the minister does agree that the implementation of self-isolation will be tricky legally. These are simply measures to try and prevent the virus from being imported back into the country.
But they're not. I mean, with respect, the minister is imposing an ineffective self-isolation if you're arriving in from some European countries who have a lower R rate than Ireland. And yet there's no self-isolation if you arrive in from the UK, which has a much higher R rate than Ireland. So we're requiring people to quarantine if you come in from countries that have performed better than Ireland, but no quarantine if you come from the country that has performed worse.
And if people from yep. Great Britain, not necessarily Northern Ireland, will be asked to self-isolate for 14 days.
Not true. You can come across the border in Northern Ireland. Therefore, there's no quarantine.
And from Britain, you will be asked to self-isolate.
The concept of a quarantine is completely ineffective. If you don't quarantine people at the airport, once you allow them onto Dublin bus, once you allow them onto the taxis, if you have a coronavirus positive person, then the infection spreads. A quarantine that gets imposed only after you've used public transport to get to your eventual destination is not a quarantine. It is simply political gameplay. It's quite clear the scientific experts across both from the European Centre for Disease Control and EASA have allowed people to move again. All of the Italian countries are lifting their travel restrictions. They're removing ineffective quarantines at a time when Ireland is imposing an ineffective quarantine, but they're doing so using face masks. That's what Ireland should be doing. It's time to go back flying. Ryanair will be flying from the 1st of July to countries all over Europe, but we require you to wear face masks.
In a letter from on May the 8th, Dr. Tony Hoolan, the Chief Medical Officer here, said the principal public health objective of the National Public Health Advisory Team's advice is to eliminate, in as far as is possible, all non-essential travel. In particular, ENFIT is concerned that Irish residents may be actively planning to resume travel overseas in the near term for tourism purposes. His priority is to try and keep the virus out of the country.
Well, I mean, it's a bit late. The virus is already in the country, but it's being successfully tackled by the government and by the health authorities. But the point we're making, that was May the 8th. We're nearly now at the end of May. Italy has opened up for tourism, removed all travel restrictions. Spain has opened up for tourism, all removed all travel restrictions. We're going back flying on the 1st of July. And yet at that moment of opening, Ireland introduces an ineffective quarantine, which has no basis in science, no basis in health measures. And all we're saying is all of the science across the airlines, across Europe and across the world says wear face masks. That's the effective protection. Useless quarantines or ineffective quarantines don't work. And we're also calling today, by the way, if there was more use of face masks, things like hairdressers could now open up before the end of June instead of waiting until the 20th of July. The government needs to explain why Ireland, with one of the best records against in tackling the COVID-19 virus, and they deserve great credit for that, now is imposing the most stringent lockdowns of any European country. We are being overly conservative. It is time to reward the Irish people with relaxation of these measures. We would call for, instead of 3-week gaps, 2-week gaps, and straight away remove an ineffective quarantine, and a more liberal use of face masks would allow things like hairdressers to reopen and would allow the people to start travelling on holidays, which, by the way, they will do from the 1st of July when Ryanair goes back flying.
On the issue of masks, just want you to hear what was said on prime time last night. Here's the head of surgery at the Mater Hospital, Professor Ronan Cahill.
And that has implications for things like airlines, who really are talking a lot about masks at the moment. Because if you're just focused on just one view of the how masks work, you won't see that horizontal plume. You wouldn't like to be sitting beside someone who's wearing a mask and breathing, speaking or coughing. Although we can have research that shows this stuff, we really need experts in each industry to come forward and make sense of it for their own area. The research can inform it, but the responsibility of how to use it rests with each of those individual experts.
Michael O'Leary?
Couldn't agree more. The experts have already come forward in the airline industry. The European Centre for Disease Control, the ECDC, and EASA, the European Safety Agency, 10 days ago published a comprehensive document of safety measures which allows airlines to go back flying. What do they recommend? Face masks, temperature controls, and hand sanitization. That's why the airlines have been flying in China now for more than 2 months. How many cases of COVID did they have in China yesterday? 7. China's back moving again. Ireland needs to get back moving again. This idea that we have this plan set out in early May, which was a different time, that doesn't allow things like hairdressers to reopen until the 20th of July, that says people arriving in from Europe should ineffectively quarantine only after they've used public transport, need to be reviewed. The government needs to lead this country. Advisors advise, ministers decide. It's time we got our ministers to start making decisions, open up the hairdressers, and certainly as far as air travel is concerned, Ryanair's going back flying on the 1st of July. We have 1,000 flights a day, and people, Irish families, are already booking well-earned holidays abroad in Spain and Portugal and Greece, which are open for business, while Ireland is reintroducing an ineffective quarantine.
Yes, but your advice is based on your priority, which is Ryanair. The advice the government
is
following.
No, that's not true.
The advice the government is following, if you let me finish my point, is based on public health advice, which is in the interest of the public health of the population.
You couldn't be more wrong. Our advice is based on the comprehensive medical advice produced by the European Centre for Disease Control, the EU Safety Medical and Safety Agency, the Uber boss. They say go back flying, but with passengers and cabin crew wearing face masks, everybody wearing face masks in terminal buildings where social distancing isn't possible. That is the science. That is the advice. It's free, it's safe to go back flying. And by the way, if this government made a more liberal use of face masks, you could readily reduce from 2 meters to 1 meter, achieve physical separation, and allow things like hairdressers to go back to work as well. It is time we went back to work. The science supports the airlines going back flying, not even on the 1st of July. Going back flying in mid-June. That's why Spain is already opening up. Spain has, which had a much worse COVID record than Ireland, has removed all travel restrictions. So has Italy. So has Greece. The Irish families are booking to go abroad, and they can do in perfect safety, fully supported by the science of the ECDC, the European Centre for Disease Control, and EASA.
When will you refund people whose Ryanair flights have been cancelled?
Continuing to do it on a daily basis. At the moment, we have a record backlog of refunds. We have about 3 months of flight cancellations imposed on us by governments. We have a total liability of about 1.2 billion. As of the end of this week, we'll be about a third of the way through that. We have about 400 million has already been refunded through refunds, vouchers, and free moves to customers, and we keep eliminating or working our way through the backlog. But it is very difficult.
A third. How long will it take to refund?
Our offices don't return to full-time work until the 1st of June.
Okay.
We don't have the full refund complement of team in place.
Could it take up to a year to refund everyone?
No, I mean, I think it will take... I mean, it's likely to take anything between 3 to 6 months to complete the job, but a lot of that depends. We think an awful lot of our passengers who are waiting for refunds will happily take free flight moves once they know we're back flying safely.
But for those who don't want to fly, for those who would like their money back?
They will get their money back. There's no issue over them refunding their money. They'll just have to wait because, sometime over the next 3 to 6 months.
That's Ryanair's Michael O'Leary, 23 minutes past eight.
The number of people who've died from COVID-19 in Ireland rose to 1,615 last night when 9 new deaths were reported. But in another positive indication that the virus is under control, the number of new cases fell to 37, the lowest number of new cases reported since March 13th. We're joined in studio now by the Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, Dr. Colm Henry. Dr. Henry, good morning and you're very welcome to Morning Ireland.
Good morning.
Can I ask you first of all about what you heard there from Michael O'Leary? He says, once you allow people out of the airport, the infection spreads and the current measures, they're ineffective and they're unimplementable. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, could I sympathise with anybody whose travel plans have been disrupted as a consequence of COVID-19 and our collective efforts to, and our collective advice that we're all sticking to break the chain of transmission of this virus. And also sympathise with families and particularly older people who've really made huge sacrifices over the past few months in order that we collectively can break the chain of transmission of this virus. It's important to remind people of the gains, not just the ones you've outlined there in your opening comment there. We've now seen a 70% reduction in the number of people in intensive care units and 70% reduction in the number of people with COVID-19 in our hospitals. We've seen the virus beaten off the streets of our towns and cities into households, so much so that the number of contacts per identified case has gone from a peak of about 20 now to less than 3, in some cases 2. And those gains have been hard fought for, and they came in because of those measures introduced March the 27th, and we as a single people adhering to those measures in order that we could break that chain of transmission and bend that curve and effectively extinguish the virus in our streets.
There were a wide range of measures, but specifically in relation to quarantine, as Michael O'Leary says there, he's claiming that measure, the particular requesting people to self-quarantine when they arrive at an airport, then letting them on a bus to God knows where, that's ineffective and really it's unimplementable. That the virus will start spreading if you don't quarantine people at the airport. You need other measures like mask wearing, for example.
I don't accept that the principle of quarantining is ineffective. It's been brought in not just in our country, but in many European countries, the United States and Canada. And it's brought in as our knowledge of the behaviour of this virus evolves, including the awareness that there's asymptomatic transmission. That is to say, people may be carrying the virus in the absence of symptoms. The advice given to people, and they're asked to, it's mandatory advice, is to self-quarantine, and they're expected, as the advice we've given through our own HPSC, to take measures that are appropriate on public transport if they're going to wherever facility they're choosing to self-isolate, including the wearing of masks. I think it's unrealistic for us to quarantine everybody at an airport. What we expect people to do, as other countries do, is to people to commit to self-quarantining for 14 days in recognition of the fact that many people may have, or that people may have asymptomatic carriage of this virus and not be aware that they're potentially infectious.
This virus was first brought into the country by people who travelled abroad. Are you happy for people to go back flying in large numbers on July 1st, as Michael O'Leary says they will? I mean, what would you say to people who are thinking of booking a holiday, a family holiday now at this point?
The first thing I'd like to say is again to sympathise with people whose plans be disrupted and to pay tribute to everybody's commitment in this country. As a people, we've come together remarkably. This hasn't been a success for government or for NPHET or for any individuals such as myself or anybody else in the HSE. This has been due to the efforts of every single Irish person who's played their part, and particularly older people who've suffered a great deal. So what I would say in answer to your question is we should take great care before we jump in and reverse those significant gains we've made since March the 27th in bending and smashing that curve.
Great care. Are you saying don't fly?
At this point in time, we would not be advising people to fly. If you look at the easing of social measures, that roadmap that's been laid out by government, the easing involves from a journey from staying at home to staying local. In other words, and monitoring every single step as we go along the way to make sure that there's no increase in outbreaks, no increase in numbers, and no rocketing up of that R value. And if I could just add very quickly, we know, again, what we've learned about this virus in the past couple of months is that R value that people will be very familiar with now, that can escalate very rapidly if those measures are loosened too quickly.
You said yesterday that if this virus is not extinguished, it is virtually extinguished at this point of time. That's obviously very good news for a lot of people. Does this mean that any of the restrictions, for example, maybe school closures, that they could be lifted more quickly than outlined in the government's plan?
Again, what we issue and what NPHET issues and through NPHET, through government, and is advice to different settings, including schools. When I said yesterday it's virtually extinguished, I was referring to the fact that we've gone from our testing positivity rate, that means the amount of people who are tested to prove positive, from a peak of 25%, albeit when we were testing lower volumes of people, to now falling week on week to now less than 2%. We've seen this virus virtually eliminated from our streets, but we must, and that roadmap reflects this concern, we must take great care as we ease these restrictions that we don't allow the virus back onto our streets and don't see the spectre of widespread community transmission leading to our hospitals being overrun and our intensive care units oversubscribed.
Can I ask you about nursing homes? The Oireachtas Committee yesterday heard that the HSE was provided with a list of high-risk nursing homes by HICWA back in March. How long before you contacted those homes and took specific actions in them?
We have, right from the beginning, we've made no distinction between private and public nursing homes. As people will know from commentary in recent days, 80% of nursing homes are in the private sector. From the very beginning of this crisis, and as we grew awareness of the nature of behaviour of this virus, particularly among older people, we made no distinction between public and private nursing homes in terms of the measures we felt were necessary to break the chain of transmission, including infection prevention and control advice, including on-site assessment of nursing homes, including provision of PPE to date, if I could say.
Did you go through that list that you were provided with from HICWA via the Department of Health and specifically target actions in the nursing homes that were on that list in terms of supplying them, making sure they had adequate PPE, testing of staff, testing of patients?
Not just on that list. Every single nursing home was contacted by our area crisis management control teams right across, of which there's 23 right across the country. And during that time, right into April, we contacted every single nursing home, public or private. We instigated a series a series of measures right up to and including provision of staff and redeployment of staff from within the HSE to public nursing homes, but also to private nursing homes. So yes, we did act upon the concerns of HICWA, but it wasn't just focused on those 19 facilities, it was focused on all facilities in order that we would put in place those essential infection prevention and control measures that would break the chain of transmission of the virus.
When did you act on that list?
We were right from the level of awareness when the first actions were taken, and the first level of awareness was taken of increased numbers of cases in nursing homes. And bear in mind,
and
from the end of March onwards, we were working actively with nursing homes and residential care facilities in the public and private sector.
Is there any difference in the severity of the outbreak in public nursing homes compared to private nursing homes? For example, do you have a breakdown now of the cases and deaths in public homes compared to private homes?
Well, the deaths show a proportionate differential between public and private facilities. As I said, 80% of facilities are in the private sector, and the breakdown of deaths, and I, again, if I could extend my sympathy to the families and friends of each and every one of these deaths, each of which is a tragedy to those families, the proportion of deaths were broken down in the same way that 80% of the fatalities were in private facilities and 20% in publicly run facilities.
Okay, but I suppose what I'm asking you is, do we know whether public facilities perform differently to private facilities in terms of how they handle this virus?
There's no distinction. The public facilities are different in that they're run directly by the HSE and have HSE staff, and the private facilities are privately owned. The medical care is provided for the most part by general practitioners, either a single general practitioner or groups of general practitioners. And my own role as a geriatrician, I've had occasion to visit both facilities many times, and I've seen many private nursing homes, just to dispel any doubt, which are very well run and where excellent care is given by general practitioners who've developed a knowledge and expertise in all facets of the complex care that older people require in these settings.
So were the outcomes better in public nursing homes than they were in private nursing homes? Is that what you're saying?
I see no distinction, but there is an expert advisory group which is now set up by the minister, a review group which will look at the whole experience we've had in the residential care setting and give us advice on what lessons can be learned to avoid outbreaks in the future. And to point out, we've seen, with the reduction in community transmission of the virus, we have seen no outbreaks in residential care facilities since last week.
Which is good news. And good news to finish on, Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland.
Hibernia REIT saw its business grow again in the year to the end of March, but it says the market outlook is negative in the short term as the impact of COVID-19 will have on rents and property values remains unknown. Hibernia is one of the biggest commercial property owners in the country with 34 properties, all in Dublin, most of them offices, but it said it had sufficient headroom to deal with a COVID shock and could withstand a 65% fall in asset values. The CEO of British property group Hammerson is to step down. Hammerson specialises in retail properties and is the co-owner of the Dundrum Town Centre, the Pavilion in Swords and the ILAC in Dublin City, and owns a significant minority stake in Kildare Village. It's been struggling to deal with the impact of retail closures due to COVID-19, as well as the collapse of a £400 million deal that would have seen it offload 7 of its British retail parks. And the International Energy Agency says it expects investment in energy projects to fall by 20% this year. It warns that could lead to a supply problem as the global economy and demand recovers due to the long lead-in time involved in building new energy facilities. Finally, the currencies, where €1 buys you $1 and 9.5 cent and 89.1 pence sterling.
Bayern Munich took a big step towards retaining their Bundesliga title last night. They had a 1-0 win away to second place Borussia Dortmund, and that win puts them 7 points clear of Dortmund with 6 games to go. Premier League clubs will vote today on a return to full contact training ahead of a possible restart of the season next month. Now, so far there's been 8 positive results over 1,700 tests carried out since teams resumed restricted training. The 12th of June is the date they're looking at in terms of a resumption of action. Irish Racing returns next month, and RTE will broadcast a new 1-hour live TV programme in June and early July. The first show will feature the Irish 2000 Guineas on the 12th of June from the Curragh. Trainer Willie McCreary has been telling Dave Keena about the importance of this return to action.
I say, I'm like every other trainer, we think the 8th of June now is like Christmas Day now. We're all waiting to open up our parcels and see what the horses can bring on the 8th of June. It's queer times, but it's great to have a starting date, you know.
And it was pretty frustrating there for a while, but the fact now that we have a definitive date, everybody can kick on and get on with their job now.
Yeah, it's very frustrating for trainers, you know, to be telling owners we're going to start in all different dates, and then you hear your warrant and everyone was, you know, very, very frustrated. But look, we have a starting date now, and let's move on. And I mean, it's not as frustrating as a lot of people in other circumstances around the country.
I think we're all looking forward to a little bit of live sport, Willie. Looking forward to that one. Something a little bit different in our Moment series this morning. On the 27th of May, 1993, this day, 27 years ago, Dawson Stelfox became the first Irishman to conquer Everest, the world's highest mountain. Now, this is a really significant and historic moment. I think it probably transcends sport, really, because it was the coming together of an all-Irish team. So, climbers from the north and south of the border, a team of 15 travelled, including 8 climbers, but Stelfox was the only one to summit. Keep an ear out for an interview as he, from the top of the mountain, he did with the Today Show on RTÉ Radio 1.
Once there was a mountain called Peak 15. Nothing was known about it. But in 1852, the surveyors found it was the highest in the world, and they named it Everest.
You'll be able to hear exclusive radio coverage of the expedition and its progress on this program.
The altitude is hitting 84 meters. I'm sitting on summit of the world.
That's how Dawson Stelfox told his team by shortwave radio yesterday that he'd made it to the summit of Everest. The Irish chose the difficult North Ridge route on a mountain which many have tried to climb, many have failed to climb, and where some have died.
If we get two people, even if we get one person on the summit, I as leader would certainly be happy. But I mean, certainly for me, I would like to be one of the ones who gets there, and I think that would be the same for everybody.
In the event, he was the only one to make it. They met bad weather on the way up. On the final assault, the deputy leader, Frank Nugent, had to turn back because of oxygen problems. But they also had luck. Yesterday, a window in the weather opened. That allowed the attempt and ensured its success.
It's an honour to be sitting up here. And an honour to be given this top possibility by everybody else in the team. And I'd like to think I represent all the other climbers, all the other members of the expedition.
It took 5 years to plan, over 3 months to complete, and cost over £150,000. Dawson Stelfox succeeded where others failed, becoming the first Irishman to stand on the summit of Everest.
Tremendous to be representing Irish mountaineering, because we feel very much that we were just representatives of a huge group of people who are interested in climbing and climb all over the world themselves.
Why should a man climb Everest? Because it is.
Yeah, still a wonderful achievement from that team. Finally, I might have opened a can of worms a couple of weeks ago with our Saipan piece, because today, believe it or not, is the 18th anniversary of when RTE aired one of the most memorable interviews of all time, that one between Roy Keane and Tommy Gorman. Well, if you'd like to check it out in full, you can do so this evening on the RTE Sport YouTube channel. It's at 6 o'clock this evening. More details on the RTE Sport website throughout the day. Enjoy that one.
The government has been advised to introduce a significant stimulus plan for the economy when the immediate COVID-19 crisis is over. However, the budgetary watchdog, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, has also warned that all options must be kept on the table, including spending cuts and tax rises, to bring the public finances back in line once recovery takes hold. The Council was set up at the insistence of the Troika during the last financial crisis to try to ensure similar mistakes weren't repeated. Sebastian Barnes is its acting chairperson. We can speak to him now. Sebastian Barnes, good morning.
Good morning.
In the report, you say that actions taken so far to tackle the immediate economic crisis have been appropriate. Tell us more.
So the COVID crisis was a huge shock, obviously, to many aspects of life. But in terms of the economy, it's been a very quick, very sharp shock. We've got almost a third of the population is either unemployed or on some kind of short-term work scheme or being assisted. We've probably got a 20% fall in economic activity in the early part of the year. So it's a massive shock and very, very disruptive, particularly for businesses that face big cash flow pressures. So it's been absolutely right that the government has used its balance sheet very quickly, put a lot of money into the economy to make sure that the businesses survive, to make sure that people can make it through this really difficult period of lockdown.
We don't really know what's going to happen next, of course, but there are many different paths the economy could go down. You outlined three scenarios in the report, what you call mild, central and severe. Which path do you think we're heading down at the moment?
So hopefully, I think it's very hard to tell, and I think you're right about that, but hopefully I think we're heading more towards the central scenario, which is basically that the lockdown measures are eased, as the government says, and then we'll be still in a difficult situation, but the economy should gradually recover over time. Investment will be very weak, consumer spending by people will be very weak, trade will be weak, but eventually, particularly if there are these stimulus measures, those things should pick up. So we very much hope that's the scenario.
And the report says that different measures will need to be introduced during different phases of the crisis. Like what?
So basically, so here we're just in the emergency phase, so we've had these supports. Over the next couple of years, probably, we'll be in this period of high unemployment, weak demand, and so that's when we're going to need the stimulus, probably a package over several years, a sizable package, probably we're talking about billions of euros will be needed, and that will probably last for a couple of years. But over the life of a new government that might last 5 years, over the second half of that period, most likely, we'll then need a period of adjustment. Public debt will be very high, which will be necessary because of the crisis, but will mean that in the future Ireland will be vulnerable to shocks, for example, to higher interest rates or to other crises that might hit. And there'll be a big permanent gap in the budget balance, perhaps around 6 billion in the central scenario, but it could be a lot more than that. So it could be less if we're lucky. And so it's during that period that some adjustment measures will be needed. But I think a key message is whichever of these scenarios you take, including the severe scenario, much less adjustment will be needed than was the case in 2008 and 2010. So we think it should be possible to avoid a return to the kind of severe austerity that people will remember from 10 years ago.
Yes, but when you say adjustment, you are talking about some austerity. In other words, tax hikes and spending cuts, aren't you?
Absolutely. So, again, there is a lot of uncertainty, but I think it's very likely there will need to be some combination of spending reductions, or at least putting spending on hold, at least freezing spending for a while, and some tax increases. As I said, the scale of it should be nothing like what we saw in 2008 and 2010.
There are other risks, of course, apart from the pandemic, such as a hard Brexit and changes in international tax, for example.
Exactly. So I think obviously the COVID crisis is by far and away the biggest risk, both in terms of what happens with the evolution of the pandemic and also what the economic consequences of those are. But we shouldn't forget that actually a year ago we were talking about the risk of a hard Brexit. That risk hasn't gone away. It may still be there at the end of the year, and it could be very harmful. I think we need to take that into account. And it's the same on the corporation tax side. The state has become very reliant on corporation tax from multinational companies, which is a net injection of money to the economy. If that were to evaporate overnight or run down fairly quickly, that would also make the situation more difficult.
Sebastian Barnes from the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, thank you for speaking to us. Brexit and fish. Yes, as Tony Connolly was telling us earlier, there are fears that the EU's chief negotiator is softening his stance in negotiations with the UK on fishing rights. Irish fisheries are holding on to the hope that Michel Barnier will stand by the mandate of European member states that the UK will not be entitled to free trade unless there's an agreement to continue fishing in each other's waters. Sean O'Donoghue is CEO of Killybegs Fishermen's Organisation. We can speak to him now. Sean O'Donoghue, good morning.
Good morning.
What are you worried about?
We're worried that there is a softening of the position from the very clear
mandate that the council gave to Michel Barnier, which that fisheries would be negotiated in the context of the wider trade negotiation, and that we would uphold the existing access and quota share arrangements. And it is very clear and unambiguous in the mandate, and I'm really pleased that the fisheries minister made it in no uncertain terms again clear to Michel Barnier yesterday that that is the mandate that he has from them.
What makes you worried that he is softening his stance?
Well, I think there is a lot of spin and counter-spin coming from London in relation to this, and they're obviously putting a lot of stay on fisheries because they feel that is the only area that they have any upper hand on the EU as such. So it is very important for them to break the link between the overall trade and fisheries as such. And that is, he is coming under pressure in the negotiations,
That's pressure from London. What evidence do you have that Michel Barnier is bending to that pressure?
Well, I think to be fair, even from a fisheries point of view, we want it is in all our interest that there is a deal here at the end of the year. So I would imagine that the other sectors are putting pressure as well that we need in the interest of both the UK and the European Union to have as close a trade deal as possible.
Zonal attachment could be one form of a deal or a compromise. What does that mean?
What that means is that they're basically claiming that the fish are in their waters so that they can take the majority of them. But as you know, fish don't recognise artificial boundaries on the sea, and what fish are here today could be in other waters in 20 years' time. So this concept of zonal attachment is not acceptable, and it is totally contrary to what is laid down in the mandate. So it would be, if Michel Barnier is negotiating on zonal attachment, he's certainly not doing it in accordance with the mandate he's been given by the council as such.
Are you or your fishermen expecting any change at the end of this year to the way that you fish?
Well, we're adamant at the moment, and we have been from the very beginning, that access is critical to us, as indeed is the quota shares. So what we're saying, if we do end up losing out on access here, this is a disaster for us as such. Because we are very much dependent. If you take our two main stocks, which make up about 60% of the total value of first sales landings, if you take mackerel, for example, we're 60% dependent on access to UK waters. If you take prawns or Dublin Bay prawns, we're 40% access, and they combine together, as I said, to make up 60% of our value. So if we lose that, this will be dreadful for the fishing industry, and our seafood industry, which is worth 1.22 billion, I would see that could be reduced by 500 million if we're denied that access, and we could lose 4,000 to 5,000 jobs out of our 16,000 jobs out in the fishing industry.
Sean O'Donoghue, CEO of Killybegs Fishermen's Organisation, thank you for speaking to us.
At 9:30 p.m. tonight, Irish time, history will be made when two American astronauts launch into space from the Kennedy Space Centre on the Florida coast. Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken will become the first pair to make the trip to the International Space Station in a rocket and capsule provided by a private company, SpaceX, which was founded by Elon Musk. To tell us more about the mission, we can talk now to space commentator and broadcaster Leo Enright. Leo, good morning. How big a deal is this?
This is very important for the United States because since the end of, since the middle of 2011, that's 9 years ago, they've been relying on the Russians to launch their astronauts to the International Space Station. We here in Europe have also relied on the Russians because the Americans shut down their space shuttle program. Now, today, for the first time, the Americans will be launching from their own soil, from Cape Canaveral, these two men on a test mission. This is critical to ensure that this system works.
If it goes well, what does it mean for the future of space exploration? The fact that these men are travelling on effectively a private taxi, if you will, up into space.
Well, that's exactly right. And it really could change everything. The idea that they can safely launch, this is Elon Musk, his SpaceX company, that they can safely launch humans to the International Space Station would open up the prospect that they could start launching tourists who pay for their own ride. And it could become potentially a big, big business.
The astronauts involved, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, they're no spring chickens either, are they? They're aged 49 and 53, so they've been around the block.
Oh, yeah, well, let's not be too ageist about it. They are experienced astronauts and were picked for that reason. They're also interesting because both men are married to astronauts. It's certainly, as far as I know, the first time that we've had astronauts launching into space who are also, both of them, the husbands of astronauts.
It's significant, of course, because of the fact that there's a launch taking place on US soil for the first time in 9 years, also that it's a private company. But what will they actually be doing?
Well, the mission itself is a test of the launch system. They want to make sure that they can safely send two astronauts to the space station, link up with the space station, and then potentially, although NASA are a bit vague about this, they could spend a number of weeks living and working on the space station if everything goes well tonight.
There is an Irish connection to this mission, Leo, but only if it goes wrong, isn't that right?
Well, yes, this is quite interesting. I should emphasise that it's we're not expecting this to happen, but the blunt reality is that spaceflight is a dangerous business. These men will lift off from Cape Canaveral. They will blast their way up the east coast of the United States. They will enter orbit high up above the Atlantic if everything goes well. But if anything goes wrong in the final seconds before they go into orbit, there's only one thing they can do. They can fire their booster rocket to aim themselves to splash down in the Atlantic Ocean just 40 kilometers from Skellig Michael. They will land in the Atlantic Ocean just 40 kilometers off the coast of Ireland.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Leo Enright, space commentator and broadcaster, thank you very much for talking to us on Morning Ireland. The time is 3 minutes to 9.